mind cable to turn off or something. Watch mine turn on.
Oops.
Yeah. Everybody else, but the... University of Florida at Gainesville. A little warmer down there, and just a tiny bit. So we're getting used to some cold weather. But he's not unfamiliar with it because he started off in Canada. He had his BS in the University of Saskatchewan in physiology, and then went on for his master's at the University of Toronto, and his PhD at the University of Toronto. Finished up there in 92, and then PhD in 96, which is really quite interesting because it was in the Department of Physiology, and I was there as my postdoc time in 92 to 96, but we don't remember seeing each other too much. Maybe I had more hair or something. But we do both remember that there was a bratwurst stand outside the end of the field, and so maybe we were fighting over who's in line first for that. But there's also another interesting connection here. He was actually the mentor of Tim Butterfield a long time ago, right? A postdoc mentor, and so that was really quite interesting. So after finishing up his PhD in Toronto, he went on for a postdoc at the University of San Diego, right?
California.
USD, University of California. And then after that, back to the cold country, back up into Canada, and he went over to McGill University, went right to the ranks very quickly, assistant, full professor, director of the research lab up there in muscle physiology, and then, what was it, a year ago, here, about 2 years ago, been recruited down to the University of Florida at Gainesville by some of the people that maybe some of you remember, Karen Esser and Mike Reed, are down at the University of Florida at Gainesville, wonderful people, so somehow they're getting all these muscle people down there. We're going to have to reel them back up here. And so it's been a real pleasure over the years. Dr. Hempel has published numerous articles, 90 articles, and covered quite an array of skeletal muscle physiology, from capillary infusion, development of skeletal muscle, aging of muscle, and really some very interesting work. More recently in mitochondrial dysfunction, and I think that's part of the talk that we'll have today. And not only that, a lot of students that he's mentored, graduate students, postdocs, Tim, and a number of undergraduates, which is really quite nice to see as well, right? Students coming into the lab. And so now he's down at University of Gainesville, Florida, Gainesville, faculty member there, and they're running a research, wonderful research program. Recently had his, what was it, $32 million grant? That's a...
It's not just mine.
It's not this year, but still, I mean, you know, are you recruiting students or maybe sabbatical people? great. And some pilot grants as well. So I don't want to take any more time, but just an impressive background, impressive work in muscle physiology. This talk is co-sponsored with the Center for Muscle Biology. If you don't know, we have a Center for Muscle Biology here on campus. I encourage you to look at the webpage and the Ribble Endowment Fellowships for undergraduates and enrichment seminar. Without any further delay, Russ, take it away. You already got your title up here. Mitochondrial and aging muscle atrophy. Sensitivity is the key. All right.
All right. Thank you, Robin, for that very nice introduction. And thanks to all of you for coming. So as Robin has told you, I have a few links with a few people here. I've also known Esther DuPont for many years as well. So it's really nice to be here and see you folks.
So, yeah, I'm still getting used to gaiters and stuff. It's kind of weird. I still see them every day on campus. Okay, do I run? Do I just walk slowly? Anyway, so I have to make a disclosure to start off. Some of you may know this already about me, but I'm a mitochondriac.
Those of you who don't know what a mitochondriac is, it's actually defined. Okay? It's defined as a biochemist, but I'm a physiologist, so we'll just go with that. It is a chronic and unusually intense interest in mitochondria and all things mitochondria. And not only am I a mitochondriac, but I'm married to one. And we have matching t-shirts. All of this is true. Okay? And anyway, so that gives you a bit of background on me and my infatuation with this wonderful organelle, the mitochondria, and maybe gives you a bit of a perspective on how I'm going to approach things. The mitochondria has certainly been implicated in aging in many different facets. It's been a very popular concept in trying to explain why muscles degrade as we age. And as I've gone along, I've kind of looked at this from the point of view, is like, well, all right, is this circumstantial evidence? Is the mitochondria just always there when the action's happening? Or is it actually the real culprit that it's often fingered to be? So that's really been one of my main motivations, trying to understand that. So what I'm going to address with you is I'm going to talk about mitochondrial theory of aging as it relates to muscle and some of the ways that we think about mitochondria maybe involved and where I think we should be looking to try to see its involvement, the concepts of how these things might be involved with aging, the evidence that mitochondria is actually involved with aging muscle atrophy, how strong is it, what does it tell us, and then specifically I'm going to be focusing on this thing called mitochondrial permeability transition. So I met with a few of you today, and I know that a couple of you hadn't actually heard of this before, so you're going to hear more about it now, and anyway, I'll tell you more about that as we get to it, and then I'm going to talk specifically about some mechanisms that can sensitize mitochondria to undergo permeability transition. And, you know, just to couch everything or to telegraph where I'm going, that really seems to be the key issue, is this sensitization of mitochondria to this process of permeability transition. So just to start off, those of you who don't know a whole lot about aging muscle other than to know what you see with your own eyes, perhaps, which is that muscles get smaller as we age, all right? I actually view this as being a process that evolves over time, all right? So, you know, aging is not so much a destination as a journey, right? It's a continuum. And so to think about, you know, what is old muscle, really, I think we need to think about when in that continuum we're looking at it, because it might look one way at one point and look quite different at a later point. And to just illustrate that, if we look at healthy young adult muscle, all right, we've labeled here with antibodies against type 1 myosin heavy chain, so these are the blue muscle fibers, type 2A in the red, and then type 2X plus laminin in the green. So we've got the three muscle fiber types in young adult muscle, and then we've got this kind of older age group, all right, where you can see, oh, okay, it looks like there's been some atrophy here of the muscles, but the muscle fibers look like it's more of a uniform atrophy rather than anything that's more heterogeneous. And that contrasts quite dramatically with what we see when we go to advanced age, when the real feature that we see in advanced age in muscle is extreme heterogeneity. Some muscle fibers look completely fine, or relatively. I mean, they don't look that different than they did, you know, 3-4 decades earlier. But what we see sandwiched between these things are these very small angular muscle fibers. These ones, it turns out, are persistently denervated. So they've been denervated for at least months, probably, and perhaps considerably longer. So they become unplugged and not plugged back in. And so to me, when I think about aging muscle, these are some of the things that I think about in kind of, you know, how this process evolves over the life course. So how do mitochondria fit here? All right, that's still a big open-ended question. And when we approach this, you know, we can think about it from at least three different facets, but probably many, many more. But I'm just going to focus on three. All right, so the most obvious one is we know that mitochondria are involved in generating ATP, and in doing so, they consume oxygen. Okay, great. That's one thing we can deal with. So perhaps with aging, there's a diminution in the capacity of mitochondria to generate ATP. Also, the mitochondria generate reactive oxygen species. You know, for many years, we always thought of that in a negative context, but we now understand a bigger picture where, okay, mitochondrial ROS are actually important for signaling and signaling stress. And in the case of muscle, probably signaling stress related to adaptive processes, right? So we don't necessarily want to just stop all ROS, right? We need to understand when it maybe reaches pathological thresholds. And then the last thing we can talk about, or at least that I will talk about today in this context, is the mitochondria is a regulator of the intrinsic pathway of apoptosis. Now, Esther, I don't know where, there you are, Esther will remember this. she and I have chatted for many years about what does apoptosis mean in a skeletal muscle fiber, because it's multinucleate. If you knock off a nucleus, the cell doesn't die. So the classical definition of apoptosis for a muscle fiber doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And frankly, I don't think we really understand very well what is the role of apoptosis in skeletal muscle, period. Right? It's still pretty nebulous. I'm going to try to shed some light on what we think might be going on in the context of aging today. But nonetheless, one of the ways that the mitochondria is involved in this is that there's a pore, the mitochondrial permeability transition pore, MPTP, that assembles under certain conditions. Okay, some of them are physiological, some of them are pathological. When it forms, if it forms and stays open for a brief time, that's generally thought to be a physiological type of pore opening. But if it stays open for a prolonged period, it allows passage of proteins from the matrix out into the cytoplasm. And many of these things, like cytochrome C, is probably the best known. But there's a handful of others, apoptosis-inducing factor, endonuclease G, and others. These things can have pro-apoptotic actions once they're released from the mitochondria into the cytoplasm. Okay? Now, again, in muscle, what does that mean? That's an open-ended question. But we can. This is one of the areas that has also been considered as a potential means by which the mitochondria might be mediating some adverse effect in muscle. So that's what we're going to be trying to address. All right. Well, if you look, and if you have looked into the literature related to the mitochondrial theories as they apply to aging muscle, these things have undergone many different iterations. All right? I don't think we're yet at a point where we can say unequivocally this is the elements of the mitochondrial theory that's most applicable. We have our own ideas about what we think might be most relevant, but I'm just going to focus on here on one of the original ideas, which relates to the fact that the mitochondrion retains a vestige of its original lineage as an independent organism, a bacteria-like organism, in that it has its own genome, right? Now, it's not nearly enough to make an entire mitochondrion anymore. It's farmed out most of the work to the nucleus, right? So it's done a good job of delegating. But it's retained the encoding for 13 essential polypeptide subunits of the electron transport system. Why just these 13 subunits and not the many hundreds of other ones? That's a bit of an open-ended question. Some people have suggested it's because of the extremely hydrophobic nature of these particular polypeptides, and it would be difficult to bring them, to import them across the mitochondrial outer membrane. I think there's some evidence for that, but to some extent, we still don't really know why these 13. But nonetheless, this is where they're distributed through the electron transport system. So there's 7 from complex 1. There's none in complex 2, so this is entirely nuclear-encoded. 1 in complex 3, 3 in complex 4, and 2 in complex 5. All right, so this is where these mitochondrial DNA-encoded subunits are located. We know that with aging, there's an accumulation of mitochondrial DNA mutations, and it has also been proposed that these may be very important in actually driving aging by causing aberrations in mitochondrial function. One thing to mention to you is that mitochondria contain multiple copies of the mitochondrial genome. Okay, many, many copies. And the mitochondria can actually tolerate pretty high levels of mutated mitochondrial DNA, somewhere on the order of 60 to 80% mutated genomes without yielding an aberrant phenotype. Okay, so there seems to be a large safety zone there. Okay? So that's quite different, where, of course, you have one nucleus and one set of nuclear DNA. But here you have multiple mitochondria, each having multiple copies of its own mitochondrial DNA. So one of the theories that really caught a lot of people's attention, including mine, in the context of mitochondria and aging muscle, is this work from Judd Aiken's group. And he's published many papers on this topic over the years, but I'm just going to highlight a couple of them. And so one of the first ones was a study that was published in FastCEP Journal back in 2001, which they were doing a double stain. So this is muscle cross-sections labeled on the top here for cytochrome oxidase or complex 4. So that's this one here. Okay, so it contains 3 mitochondrial DNA-encoded subunits. And then this is a serial section of the same muscle, and this has been labeled with succinate dehydrogenase. So that's this one, no mitochondrial DNA-encoded subunits. So if you've got mutations to the mitochondrial DNA, you could have a selective effect on cytochrome oxidase, but not succinate dehydrogenase, right? Because of that difference in what's encoding what. So what they found is that along the length of muscle fibers, that regions that had oxidative impairment characterized by a lack of cytochrome oxidase activity, these areas had very high levels of mitochondrial DNA mutations, okay, at least 80%. All right? And that was also reported to coincide with regions of fiber atrophy, as well as in some cases fiber breakage. And so it was posited that it's this segmental accumulation of mitochondrial DNA mutations that leads to severe mitochondrial dysfunction and in turn destruction of the cell. And perhaps that's how we lose muscle fibers with aging. So this was a study that was reported in rats. Sometime later, they also reported data from humans. And technically, this is really impressive work. Okay? So my hat goes off to these folks. So this is just a cartoon of the mitochondrial genome. And each one of these arcs represents a discrete mitochondrial DNA fragment, a mutation. Okay? So these are things that have had regions that aren't that have been deleted. Okay? The suggestion is that it's probably oxidative damage that's resulted in the loss of these portions of the mitochondrial genome. But these are all individual different mutations, all right, that have been sequenced from human muscle fibers. All right? So as you can see, there's a whole bunch of these. They tend to be quite varied in size, etc. But they also tend to congregate in this area, and this is called the major arc of the mitochondrial genome. All right, so this is where they tend to accumulate. All right, great. So the same sorts of things that have been shown in the rats are also shown in aging muscle. All right. Now, what they also did in this study is they had, it was a small sample size, so it was three subjects. They had a 49-year-old, 67-year-old, and I think it was something like a 90-some-year-old. I've got it in the next slide. And so they took biopsies from these folks, and then they did the same single-fiber analysis, all right, and then they looked at correlations between our accumulation of mitochondrial DNA damage and oxidative impairment, etc. So here's the data, all right. So now what they've done, instead of having those two stains, the cytochrome oxidase and the succinate dehydrogenase separate, they've done it combined, all right. So if you have cytochrome oxidase activity, the muscle fiber will appear brown. If it lacks it, it'll appear blue. So it makes it very easy to find those deficient fibers. So what you can see again is like what had been shown in the rat muscle is that, okay, here's a muscle fiber that at slide 11 seemed to have relatively normal cytochrome oxidase activity, but by the time you get to slide 25, and these are, I think, 10 micron thick slices, so you know it's moved down probably a couple, 1,500 microns here, or 150 microns, sorry. And so now it's cytochrome oxidase deficient, still deficient here, but by the time we get to slide 74, it's normal again. All right? So when they do this and they characterize these regions that have cytochrome oxidase deficiency, here's the percentage of deleted mitochondrial DNA. Boom. It's well up over 80 in these regions with dysfunctional OxPhos. Okay? But if you look at this, does anything strike you about the muscle fiber? It's not atrophied in the blue region. Okay? In fact, none of the representative images in the paper show atrophied blue fiber, blue regions. Okay? And if you read a quote from the paper, so I'm quoting directly here, intrafiber atrophy, which was defined as a cross-sectional area ratio of less than 0.5, so that just means the area of the narrowest bit relative to the fattest bits, okay? So when you got these to this threshold, that was indication of intrafiber atrophy. It wasn't observed in any of the ETS abnormal fibers from the 49-year-old subject, okay? In the 67-year-old subject and 92-year-old subject, only 5% of them showed atrophy. Okay, so I'm just quoting their paper. The paper basically concludes that this is a major cause of muscle fiber atrophy, but I would make the argument that 95% of the ETS abnormal fibers are actually not atrophied, right? So I think maybe we've been focusing on the wrong end of this equation, but that's just, you know, my 2 cents worth based upon this. So we are actually looking now at a mouse model of spontaneous accumulation of a high rate of mitochondrial DNA mutations. Some of you may have heard of the Pol gamma mutant mouse. So we're now looking at these mice to try to see what's happening in them. And just to kind of preface things, we're actually finding neuromuscular junction degeneration in these mice. So I'm going to come back to NMJs in just a few minutes. All right, so I talked to you a little bit about this mitochondrial permeability transition event. All right? And so just to kind of show you, this is formed by a dimer of the ATP synthase, and if we look at this region from above, this is where the channel is. Okay, and so you can get passage of proteins up to 1,500 kilodaltons in size. So,
oh look, there's Esther's face. Right there.
Oh no, she's so shy. So previous studies. This was actually a study done without Esther, but the next one shows her as well. Done back in 2002, and it was the first demonstration in limb skeletal muscle of an increase in apoptosis in aging. All right, and that actually been shown. I think it was in anal sphincter muscle previous to this, but this was the first time in limb skeletal muscle this had been shown. And so this is the study where Esther's the senior author, and so they were looking at 6-month-old versus 32-month-old rats, and the green here reflects apoptosis-inducing factor, AIF. And what they were finding is that muscle fibers with aging were showing an increased number of nuclei that had AIF localized there. So the only way for AIF to get to the nucleus is for it to be released from the mitochondria. Okay? Under normal circumstances, that's where it is. So where you see the green here in the young adult muscle cross-section, that's actually aggregations of mitochondria. You see lots of mitochondria in the subcircle level region, so that's why you're seeing it there. But if the mitochondria undergo permeability transition and it gets out, then it can go to the nucleus. So that's what they were seeing here. So as far back as 2005, there was evidence with aging that there's an increase in apoptosis, and it looks like it might be being mediated through mitochondrial mechanisms, right? Because there's a release of these mitochondrial-derived pro-apoptotic factors. Okay. So, going a little bit further, David Hood's lab from York University up in Canada, in Toronto, they looked at release of endonuclease G, which is another one of these pro-apoptotic factors that's housed within the mitochondrion. And what they were finding is that between 6 months and 36 months in this rat model, and 36 months in the model they were looking at here, it's the Fisher 344 brown Norway rat, that's about 35% survival rate, so about 85 years in humans if we make that relative comparison. And so they're seeing a big increase in release of endonuclease G. So these mitochondria are undergoing permeability transition and releasing this out into the medium that the mitochondria are being incubated in. Sometime after that, we were looking at this in saponin permeabilized muscle fibers. So this is in a different preparation. This was in isolated mitochondria here. What we did is we take a portion of muscle, dissect it down to about half a dozen muscle fibers, and then use a detergent called saponin to just selectively permeabilize the outer muscle fiber membrane and leave the mitochondria intact. And we can do a measure of the sensitivity of the mitochondria to undergo permeability transition by putting them in a cuvette that has calcium green. So the mitochondria take up that calcium until they can't take up that calcium anymore. Pore opens and the calcium comes back out. So we can actually use that as an assay. And the time to pore opening is a reflection of the sensitivity to permeability transition. So a shorter time means it's sensitized. All right. So with aging, we were finding that the mitochondria are sensitized to permeability transition. So that's consistent with what David Hood's group had shown, where the mitochondria are actually releasing this. So this is saying that they're more likely to open. This says they've opened. Okay. All right. Now, we also were interested in how we can maybe translate some of this to humans, and if it does. So this is work done by Gilles Gouspi, who was a postdoc in my lab back at the time. And this is a paper we had published in FASAB Journal in 2014. And we were looking at young adults and older healthy men who were quite physically active. So these folks were doing about 200 minutes of physical activity a week. So that's quite a bit. They were not, you know, trained athletes by any means, so they weren't training for specific events or anything like that. They weren't competitive. But they were definitely very physically active. And even so, the older adults had a lower muscle mass. And they also had, so this is another measurement that relates to the sensitivity to permeability transition. It's the calcium retention capacity. So the mitochondria in these older individuals are sensitized to permeability transition, just like we had seen in our rat model. Not only that, similar to what Esther and Christian Leuenberg had shown previously, is that when we look in the aged muscle fibers, we find that the nuclei are harboring higher levels, more nuclei are harboring endo-G. So remember, this is also localized within the mitochondria. It only gets to the nucleus if the mitochondria have undergone permeability transition. So again,
mitochondria are more sensitized to undergo permeability transition, and they have undergone permeability transition more frequently. So that's what we're seeing. So it looks like, yes, this is translatable. So how does it relate to atrophy? This is really, you know, the important question. All right, so we've taken advantage of the fact that in the rat, not every muscle has the same susceptibility to atrophy. Okay? And so what we've done is we've focused on these four muscles, which can be segregated based upon their fast twitch versus slow twitch characteristics. So we've got the gastrocnemius muscle and the EDL muscle, or extensor digitorum longus muscle. These two muscles are about 90-some percent fast twitch muscle in a healthy young adult animal, so they're largely fast twitch. These two muscles, the soleus and the adductor longus, are about the other end of the continuum. They're like 90-some percent slow twitch with type 1 muscle fibers in healthy young adult. So if we look at this as the starting point for each of these muscles, within the fast twitch muscles, we find that the gastroc atrophy is about 40% between 8 months and 35 months, about 21% for the EDL. The soleus I put is 21% here, but it's a bit of a, it's actually more complex than that because this muscle hypertrophies up until the age of about 28 months, okay? Because the animals are getting fat. And so that muscle, being postural, gets overloaded. It actually hypertrophies. So if you take that midpoint into account, it actually hypertrophies about 40%, the same as the gastroc. The adductor longus, though, is the real winner here in terms of aging. This thing is hypertrophying by nearly 50%. Okay? Now, there's a lot that we still need to understand about the adductor longus, but one of the things that I think is happening, so this is a muscle that's on the inside of the thigh, okay? And if you look at these animals as they age, all right, and Esther, you can correct me if you see this differently, but they kind of have splayed hips, right? Because they get this big belly, and they're like, whoa, right? So this muscle is getting stretch on it, right? Well, we know that stretch is actually one of the best stimuli for adding sarcomeres, okay, to muscles. Where's Tim? Tim knows this, right? And so, you know, we think these muscles are actually getting longer, all right? And that's part of what is driving their hypertrophy. Nonetheless, that's what we're seeing here. So we can look at these different muscles, and based upon what I've shown you about mitochondrial permeability transition, if this is important to atrophy, it should be an event that we see in the muscles that atrophy and not in the adductor longus, which doesn't, right? So that was really what we were after. And so, to just before I get into some data, I've got to give you just one more quick little bit of background info. When we look at the sensitivity of mitochondria to undergo permeability transition, the mitochondria from fast-twitch muscles behave differently than the mitochondria from slow-twitch muscles. Okay? So the mitochondria in fast-twitch muscles actually have a greater capacity to store calcium, and they take longer to reach this point of permeability transition, or pore opening, than do slow-twitch muscles. That's in a healthy young adult condition. Okay? Taking that into account, if we now look at the time to pore opening as a function of the proportion of fibers that have a fast myosin heavy chain expression, all right, because that's changing with age. So the gastrocnemius and the EDL are up here from the young adult animals. In the aged animals, there's not a big shift in the total fast isoform as a whole. There are changes within in subclasses, so that we have less 2B and more 2X, for example, in here. But the overall fast relative to slow is not changing. So these things stay where they are in terms of fast myosin heavy chain, but they have a diminished time to pore opening. So they're sensitized to pore opening. Okay? The adductor longus does nothing in terms of the time to pore opening, and neither does it change its fiber type composition. So it just basically holds the line. The soleus, though, and this might puzzle some of you who have an interest in aging muscle and you think that, oh, with aging we get a reduction in fast-twitch muscle fibers. Not if you're a soleus. The soleus actually becomes much faster with age, not slower. Okay, it started out as basically all slow, and it becomes faster as it ages. As a result, it actually is sensitized relative to what it should be for its fiber type profile. Okay, so all three muscles that exhibit atrophy are sensitized to PTP opening. We then looked at to see whether or not they exhibited, you know, evidence that the PTP had actually opened. So we looked for AIF, or apoptosis-inducing factor positive nuclei. Again, the three muscles that atrophy all show this, an increase in,
in abundance of AI have positive nuclei, the adductor longus, which hypertrophy, shows nothing. Okay? So far, this is, we're seeing this convergence, right? We're seeing that this sensitization to PTP opening and actually evidence of PTP opening is aligning with the muscle, whether it atrophies or not. So the next step was to look at the characteristics of the fibers themselves that have AIF positive nuclei. And guess what? On average, they're quite a bit smaller than the fibers that don't have AIF positive nuclei. So they're atrophied. Okay, so now this looks like it's lining up with atrophy all the way down to the single muscle fiber level. This is now getting much more interesting. So, this still leaves us with the conundrum. Okay? If this is our muscle fiber, okay, and we've got multiple nuclei, as I've already mentioned to you, here's our mitochondrion. If it becomes sensitized to PTP opening and nukes off that nucleus, what happens to the muscle fiber? Right? Anything? Does it cause atrophy? Right? That's been a burning question for a long time. And there's not been any evidence one way or the other, really. Certainly no evidence that you have to have loss of myonuclei to cause atrophy. There's actually many examples where you don't lose myonuclei and the muscle's atrophy. So, you know, those things are not intricately tied all the time. So this is a question mark, right? So we took a step back and we're thinking, all right, because we're seeing such a strong convergence here between the sensitization to PTP opening and muscle atrophy all the way down to the single fiber level, I think there's something here. But let's look at this differently than maybe has been looked at before and not focus on apoptosis. Let's focus on this permeability transition event. So what we know, when mitochondria undergo permeability transition, if that pore stays open, what we have occur with that is a large increase in mitochondrial ROS. Okay? Now, I'm going to show you a couple slides related to this in a moment, but there's actually quite a bit of literature showing that mitochondrial ROS are a strong signal for induction of muscle atrophy. So perhaps this PTP opening and mitochondrial ROS are linked. Okay? And there is some evidence in mitochondria from other tissues that when mitochondria undergo permeability transition, there is a spike in ROS. So these two things seem to be linked up. But nobody ever looked at it in muscle, as far as we know. So, just to show you some data that relates to ROS and muscle fiber atrophy. So this is a study that came from Scott Power's group, who's at UF. And what they had shown in a model of mechanical ventilation, and those of you who don't know much about mechanical ventilation, if you put an animal or a human on a mechanical ventilator, and so the animal is no longer spontaneously breathing, the diaphragm becomes mechanically quiescent. In fact, in the ICU, they give drugs to suppress the muscle so that it's not fighting the respirator, right? So the muscle is actually inactive. Well, the muscle doesn't like that. And the mitochondria spew out huge levels of ROS. And the diaphragm atrophies very rapidly. Okay? So Dr. Powers was interested in this phenomenon, and they were using a mitochondrial targeted agent called SS31 that we now know has many other properties, but one of them is that it seems to act in some way as a mitochondrial antioxidant. Okay? And when they did this, and they look at ROS emission, this is control conditions, this is mechanical ventilation, so we get a big increase in ROS with mechanical ventilation that can be quenched with this SS31 peptide. Okay? And likewise, if we look at the muscle fiber cross-sectional area, atrophy with the mechanical ventilation that's rescued with the mitochondrial-targeted antioxidant. So I think this gives you some evidence that mitochondrial ROS are indeed linked with muscle fiber atrophy. Similarly, Mike Reed, former University of Kentucky fellow, similar sort of paradigm, looking at this case at an agent called doxorubicin, which has been used for many, many years as an anti-cancer agent, particularly for things like breast cancer. And it's known to have some off-target toxic effects, and muscle doesn't seem to like it a whole lot. So one of the things that Dr. Reed has been interested in is its role in causing muscle atrophy. And so this is in a cell culture model treating C2C12 myotubes and with doxorubicin treatment. And so the muscle myotubes are getting smaller. And if you look at DCF fluorescence, which is a measure of mitochondrial ROS, we find that with doxorubicin, there's a big increase in ROS. that can again be blocked with this SS31 compound, and likewise SS31 in this case also attenuates the muscle atrophy. So another study showing a link between mitochondrial ROS generation and muscle atrophy susceptibility. Well, what about in our context? Because neither of these studies address the PTP opening side of it. So, if you look into the literature, there's actually a study from a few years back looking at doxorubicin, and I think this is in cardiac muscle. And what they showed is that under control conditions, this is the calcium retention capacity, and then with doxorubicin treatment, so the mitochondria are sensitized to undergo permeability transition. And then this is something called cyclosporin A, which is an inhibitor of mitochondrial permeability transition. So it inhibits the pore. Under control conditions, it does nothing. But if you give it with the dox, it actually rescues the dox effect. Okay? So this is preventing the pore opening. And likewise, if we look at mitochondrial membrane potential, it falls, collapses with dox due to the pore opening, and that's rescued if you give a pore inhibitor. Okay? So we felt we were on pretty solid ground here to look at to manipulate pore opening in a cell culture system and see what effect that has on mitochondrial ROS and whether that is mediating atrophy. So I have a new colleague at UF, Terrence Ryan, who's just joined us as an assistant professor, and this guy's a real go-getter. And he's another mitochondriac. I don't know if he has a T-shirt, but I might get him one because he definitely deserves it. He does a lot of his work as well in cell culture, so he's got some expertise that my lab lacks in the cell culture domain. And so what we've done together is to look at doxorubicin, which, as you know now, is a mechanism that can induce mitochondrial permeability transition, and we're now looking at how it relates to ROS. And so we're using this agent called MitoSox. So these are control myotubes, and then each of these conditions have been treated with doxorubicin. In this case, we've got a pore inhibitor, cyclosporin A. Here's another pore inhibitor, bunkrecic acid. And this is MitoTempo to block mitochondrial ROS. So what you can see here is that we get an increase in mitochondrial ROS when we get pore opening. That can be inhibited by inhibiting pore opening with either of these pore inhibitors or directly inhibiting the ROS. So we're now linking up the ROS with the pore opening in a muscle cell culture system. Likewise, if we look for nuclear translocation of AIF, which remember that's the phenotype that we see in aging muscle that corresponds to the atrophy susceptibility, again, treatment with dox, we see an increase in AIF positive nuclei that can be prevented either by blocking pore opening or blocking ROS. Okay, that's cool. What about muscle fiber or muscle myotube atrophy? Again, with the doxorubicin treatment under normal conditions with dox treatment, we induce a myotube atrophy that can be rescued by either inhibiting the pore opening or inhibiting ROS. So what we're taking from this is that coincident with pore opening, all right, is a big surge in mitochondrial ROS, and that's the real culprit that's driving the atrophy we see in aging muscle. Okay? And that the nice thing is we can use AIF and endonuclease G in myonuclei as a readout for this event. Okay, so maybe that these things are not that meaningful in terms of apoptosis and the atrophy itself, except as a readout for something that's actually driving the atrophy. That's what we're thinking now. Okay. So the next question becomes, why are the mitochondria becoming sensitized to permeability transition with aging? Okay, this is where the story gets a little more convoluted. So for those of you who are hanging on by your fingertips, hang on with me just a little longer, okay? So what we have done here is we've immunolabeled with AIF and then something called neural cell adhesion molecule. This is a cytokine that's produced by both motor neurons and muscle fibers, all right? And under normal conditions, NCAM production by muscle fibers is very low. But when a muscle fiber becomes denervated, it cranks up NCAM production. And particularly, there's a cleaved form that's, I think, 110. I can't remember the units. But anyway, there's a cleaved fraction of this that can be secreted. Okay, and when it's secreted, it actually attracts sprouting axons to reinnervate a denervated muscle fiber. So that's its function. All right? That's what NCAM does. But we can use it as a readout of a muscle fiber that either is or has been recently denervated. All right? And so what we find is that the AIF negative nuclei, this is their NCAM intensity, so that's basically baseline. And then muscle fibers that have AIF positive nuclei, they've got much higher levels of NCAM. So to a large extent, they seem to be denervated. Okay? So now the big question is denervation the cause or the result of the permeability transition? Okay? Now I'm going to give you a quick and dirty answer to that is, I don't know. Okay? But that is now the real question we're interested in. I can give you some kind of foreshadowing to where I think things are, but we do not have the black and white unequivocal answer yet. But where I think things are going is that if we look at a denervation model, so this is an experiment where they surgically cut the sciatic nerve to the distal hind limb and then looked at single muscle fibers that they isolated from the denervated muscle, and they looked at it in conjunction with either just denervation alone or denervation plus this poor inhibitor, cyclosporin A. And basically what they were finding is that denervation is inducing MPTP opening and a surge in mitochondrial ROS. Well, that's exactly what we've seen in aging muscle, right? And so it's consistent with the idea that maybe denervation is actually the cause of these features in the aging muscle fiber. I can also tell you that we have been working also with a transgenic model of sporadic denervation. It's a neurotrypsin overexpressing mouse, and so this mouse has unstable neuromuscular junctions, and the mitochondrial phenotypes we see in this mouse look a lot like aging, all right? And, you know, the most important change is that they do exhibit sensitization to permeability transition, and they have a big increase in muscle fibers that have endonuclease G positive nuclei. So that looks a lot like aging. So that's certainly proof of principle that denervation can be a cause of this event, but we don't know whether it is actually the one in aging muscle yet. So it's a nice bit of correlation. Now, to make matters even more complicated, and you're going, oh, come on, just shut up already. I need to get out of here and get a drink. But stay with me a little longer. So, of course, mitochondria are not only in muscle fibers, right? And muscle is not just this autonomous organ. In fact, it's really got a very important relationship with, guess what, motor neurons, right? We've already alluded to denervation. So when we look at the mitochondria and motor neurons, this is from a study published in 2013. This is pretty cool. To me, anyway, I know I'm a mitochondriac, and I think this is all fun, but this is really fascinating to me. So what they've shown, so these are the mitochondria in the terminals of a young, healthy young rat, and what you can see is, okay, here's the outer mitochondrial membrane. Those of you with better eyesight can see, oh, look, there's actually, you can see the cristae membranes in here. So that's what a normal mitochondrion looks like. But in the aged motor neurons in the terminals, look at these mitochondria. They're swollen, and the cristae are completely destroyed. Do you know what that's a characteristic of? Permeability transition. So when mitochondria undergo permeability transition, they swell and they rupture. Okay? So this is a pretty clear indication that these mitochondria in the terminals of these motor neurons have undergone permeability transition. Okay, so now we're seeing this on both ends, on the muscle fiber and in the motor neuron. Okay? All right. It gets even more interesting in this study. Do I show it? Yes, okay, I do. So what they showed is that, okay, here's in a young rat, and they've used immunogold labeling of cytochrome C. Cytochrome C is normally within the mitochondria, and it's part of the electron transport chain to shuttle electrons. And so normally, this cytochrome C is localized within the mitochondria. So this kind of gray area here, darker gray, these are mitochondria. You can actually just make out the cristae a bit here. And then these are immunogold labeled cytochrome C particles. So they're within the mitochondria in the young adult. Here's an aged rat, okay? And what we've got here's a mitochondrion where it's undergone swelling and destruction of the cristae. And, oh, here's some cytochrome C outside of these mitochondria. Here we've got a mitochondrion that maybe is undergoing permeability transition because these cytochrome C particles are actually on the margins of that mitochondria, maybe being released through the pore. So we have evidence that, you know, another indirect line of evidence that these mitochondria have undergone or are undergoing permeability transition. Now, I don't think I show you here. I don't. So, what they also did is they looked in the spinal cord at the cell bodies for these motor neurons. And the fascinating thing is the mitochondria there, they didn't look entirely normal either, but they didn't have this, you know, huge swelling and destruction of the cristae. But the but in the vicinity of the nuclei, there was cytochrome C. So if the mitochondria haven't released it, where did it come from? Now, this is just the authors making an interesting theory, but what they're positing is that the mitochondria in the terminals, which have undergone permeability transition and released these proapoptotic factors, those proapoptotic factors have been then carried back to the nucleus and are then going to kill the motor neuron. So we do know that with aging, we lose motor neurons. They die. All right? And perhaps this is a mechanism by which this occurs. If that happened, that would absolutely cause denervation of a muscle fiber. Okay? So all of this to say that we have evidence of some events that are happening in the muscle that converge with denervation. We don't know which is causing what. And we now, from other work, see that the same event that we've been focusing on the muscle is also occurring in the motor neuron. So this has become pretty complex when we think about that. So if we want to think about a primary mechanism that could cause mitochondria to become sensitized to permeability transition, there are some things that we can think about as culprits. So one is this process of mitophagy. So some of you will know that mitochondria have a life cycle and that mitochondria are turned over regularly. For skeletal muscle, I believe the best data indicates that the half-life for mitochondria is on the order of 7 to 10 days. So every 7 to 10 days, you've renewed half your mitochondrial content. Okay? And so what's happening during that process of renewal is regions of mitochondria that are dysfunctional, and one of the main ways that that the cell senses a dysfunctional mitochondria is through a degradation of mitochondrial membrane potential. Okay? So when that membrane potential starts to collapse, that's a signal for recruitment of stabilization of PINK1 and recruitment of PARKIN to that region of dysfunctional mitochondria, which then attracts the ubiquitin pathway to then form an autophagosome and remove these dysfunctional regions of the mitochondrial network. Okay, so this PINK1 PARKIN-mediated mitophagy. And you may have heard of that in the context of Parkinson's disease, right? So we know that this is important in the context of some forms of neurodegeneration. What happens to Parkin in skeletal muscle and in motor neurons, for that matter, with aging? Well, I can't answer the latter, but I can answer the former. So one thing I can tell you is that if we look at PINK1 or PARK2 knockout in the context of PINK1, we actually see sensitization to permeability transition. Okay, that's interesting. If we look at PARK2, we see also a sensitization to permeability transition. So this is a mechanism that can cause mitochondria to accumulate that are sensitized to permeability transition. All right? Now, if that was also to cause denervation, then I think we would be onto something. Again, at this point, we still can't say which end of this it's acting on, one or both. Now, I can also tell you that we have some human data that suggests that Parkin is actually reduced substantially in aging muscle. So perhaps this is actually an important mechanism for this sensitization to permeability transition. Certainly something to investigate. So here we are. These are the last two slides I'm going to show you. All right, so imagine we've got a motor neuron here with mitochondria around the nucleus, mitochondria on the axon, and then mitochondria in the terminals, lots of mitochondria in the terminals. And then we've got subsynaptic nuclei here in the vicinity of the neuromuscular junction, and then we've got muscle fiber mitochondria. So with aging, I've just shown you evidence that we accumulate mitochondria that are sensitized to permeability transition here. If they then do, in fact, undergo that event and we lose the motor neuron, all right, do we then have sensitization of the mitochondria within the muscle fiber that cause atrophy? All right, that's the mechanism that I think is happening. Certainly, there's evidence in models where you manipulate denervation that does occur. So we know that can occur, and I think we have some pretty good circumstantial evidence in aging muscle that it is, but it's not equivocal yet. The alternative is that the mitochondria in the muscle fiber are getting funky, okay, and that they are having some effect in driving atrophy that then leads to the
the denervation of the muscle fibers. So it's a secondary effect related to the atrophy. All right? So that's as far as I can take you today. You'll have to invite me back in another 18 months. Okay? Maybe we'll have a better answer by then. So for now, I want to thank you for your attention. I want to thank some of the key people, Gilles Gousbiou, former postdoc, Yana Kanakova, also a former postdoc now, and Terrence Ryan's lab from the University of Florida. So with that, I'd like to thank you for your attention.
I'm sure there's questions. Any questions?
You mentioned the mitochondrial DNA issues in the first part of that, time that into complexes 1 and 3, and then I just thinking those are highly responsible for producing ROS in the mitochondria. That mitochondrial DNA dysfunction is prevented through fission and fusion. Have you seen at all how fission and fusion is tied into the mechanisms you're seeing of denervation and atrophy?
So this is one of the challenges, okay? So when we think about causes of dysfunction of a mitochondria, there are lots of different paths that lead to the same end. So in this case, you know, a mitochondria undergoing permeability transition, that's probably not a specific outcome to just impaired mitophagy. It could be occurring as well with mitochondrial DNA mutation accumulation. We don't know that yet, but we will be evaluating that. And certainly, accumulation of mitochondrial DNA mutations, if you impair the fusion and fission machinery, you will accumulate more rapidly mitochondrial DNA mutations. So I think there's a lot of possibility for, you know, multiple mechanisms here to yield the same outcome. All right? Now, I think based upon the data that I showed you, the idea that mitochondrial DNA mutation accumulation within a muscle fiber is causing atrophy doesn't seem like a major mechanism, because 95% of the time they're fine. Okay? I can make another observation that relates to that as well. If you look at patients that have primary mitochondrial disease, so these are patients who have developed sporadic mutations in their mitochondrial genome, and they end up with muscle fibers that have that electron transport system abnormality, but instead of being, you know, maybe 1% or 0.5%, which is what you see in aging muscle, they have 50, 60, 70, 80, 90% of the fibers have that trait. If that was really important as a cause of atrophy, you should almost be able to see the muscle vanish on those people over a period of weeks. It doesn't happen. Okay? So I think there's another line of evidence that accumulation of mitochondrial DNA mutations in muscle fibers is not the real important driver of atrophy. It's not to say it never happens, but it's not a major cause. I think that it could be important to the motor neurons. So that's where another angle that we're gonna take. So I think in answering this issue, I think we need to look at manipulations, multiple manipulations that can cause mitochondria to exhibit the traits that we've identified as being important to the atrophy process, right? And then comparing that to what we see with aging and to try to get a sense of whether any one of them, or maybe, you know, aging is not a very homogeneous sort of event, right? I like to tell kind of the undergrads that is sometimes through my lab, if you have an interest in research, do aging research, because every rock you look under, there's a problem, right? So almost nothing works, you know, with aging the way that it used to. So in that case of multiple mechanisms, how do you define one as being the most important, right? It's a super big challenge. So I think we need to understand, you know, multiple means by which these defects can happen, and maybe the real answer to treating it is going to be not one target. It's going to be, oh, no, we have to target the fission-fusion machinery. Oh, we need to target the mitochondrial DNA repair machinery. Oh, we need to target mitophagy. Maybe that's the answer. It's not a very easy way to approach it, but maybe that's the answer. Yeah?
Just say, Jake, I'll think of genetically positive nucleotide RNA. So is it really the cause or consequence of the
That's the fun thing, right? So mitochondria are very perplexing, even to somebody like me who, you know, professes his love for the thing. So ROS can induce PTP opening, but PTP opening can also induce ROS. All right? So this is like a dog chasing its tail. And in our cell culture experiments, we've seen scenarios where we initiated a ROS event that induced PTP opening.
So absolutely, ROS can induce PTP opening. So in our experiments, when we're treating with doxorubicin, okay, which is an established pore opener, and if we inhibit just the pore, not the ROS directly, we actually get a secondary reduction in ROS. Right? So we can link the pore opening to the ROS. Okay? But we can do the opposite as well. If we just attack the ROS, we can prevent the pore opening too.
So opening can
So there's probably a number of mechanisms. One is that, you know, of course, there's ROS that's released within the mitochondrial matrix. So when the mitochondria undergo permeability transition, that ROS is released in addition to the usual ROS that is normally directed to the outside of the mitochondria. So you've got an additional source there. But then I think with the collapse of the membrane potential, that as well suppresses respiration. When respiration goes down, oxygen tension goes up within the mitochondria. That's going to be a stimulus for ROS production as well.
So, if I understand correctly, you were saying that you think that that ROS production and initiation of apoptosis may happen concurrently, but the apoptosis may not be much of a driver of these phenotypes because you're in a multinucleated fiber cell. So, if you inhibited cascades or whatever with drugs in your cell culture system,
so the simple answer is we don't know because we haven't done that yet. But I think that would be something we could challenge and target that and see whether it did.
It's really interesting to think about. Yeah. What exactly is going on?
Yeah, I mean, I'm kind of hoping that over dinner, Esther and I can chat a little bit more. Well, that's not today. Tomorrow, about what we might be able to do in the context of apoptosis and trying to sort out what it might actually mean in the context of muscle.
You almost wonder about if somebody had a broken arm and they put their arm in a cast, the muscles atrophying. At that point, would that also trigger maybe some motor neuron dysfunction that would be long term?
So the answer to that, I think, in healthy young adult people is probably not.
Okay.
So there's been work done in animal models where they've done hind limb immobilization. So I think some of this came from Sue Bodine's group. And they've looked for transcriptional markers that are sensitive to denervation. And so when you hind limb immobilize a young adult animal, some of those transcripts will go up, okay? But as soon as you reload, they go back down to baseline. An aged animal, under baseline conditions, those denervation responsive transcripts are already up, okay? Then you hind limb immobilize them, and they don't seem to do a whole lot more, but when you remobilize, it just doesn't do as well. So, I think there's reason to believe that in an aging context where the NMJs are already unstable and prone to, disconnecting, that might be a scenario where you have a more persistent effect from, say, a bed rest or a forced immobilization.
Any other questions? If not, there's also a social upstairs in 305, hosted by the graduate students in the department. Everybody's welcome to come on up, ask more questions. But right now, thank you very much for a wonderful talk.
It's a little social upstairs, but yeah. Hosted.